Well, questions? So, the list of exactly solvable problems is pretty small. So we need some approximation methods in order to actually solve reasonable problems. And king of the approximation methods is perturbation theory, which we talked about a couple of times ago. And we have nice formulas for what the energy is, first, second. You can work it out to as high order as you want. But there are problems. So one problem is divergences. That is to say, you can actually do this sum and you get infinity. And we can distinguish a couple of types of these sort of divergences if the problem happens for the high energy states. And you wouldn't think that that would happen because the energy difference is in the denominator, but there can be lots of them. Then we call that an ultraviolet divergence if the problem happens at small energy differences. Then we call that an infrared divergence. And we're not going to be much talking about those problems because they fit into the context of renormalization. And instead of dealing with discrete set of states where we have a continuum of states, what we did talk about is the problem of degeneracy, where we have states that have the same energy, so we're going to get a zero in the denominator, but we don't get a zero in the numerator. So we have this kind of shorthand for the statement. So if V connects states, that is to say, if this integral is non-zero, in the degenerate subspace, and degenerate subspace is just a way of saying that the set of states that are degenerate. And the solution always seems simpler to me than it reads in books. And all we need to do is to make up the matrix of V over the degenerate subspace and then find the eigenvectors and values of that. The eigenvalues will be the first order perturbed values for the energy. And the eigenstates, let me call them alpha and beta. If E alpha doesn't equal E beta, we show that then there'll be no connection between them. Another way we can get by is to find an operator Q which commutes with the perturbation. And then if we have states in the degenerate subspace that have different eigenvalues of Q, then we're guaranteed that there'll be no overlap between those two and they'll be good. So the latter is what happened with the Zeeman effect. We were looking at a perturbation that was the spin in the Z direction, and we happily calculated the expectation value of Z and called that the right answer and didn't worry about these perturbation problems. And the reason we could get away with that is that the states we were using, the JM states, were good. They did not connect with each other through the perturbation. And that was because we had an operator J squared or JZ, take your pick, which commuted with the spin, and the states we had had different eigenvalues of J squared and JZ. Questions? So kind of the standard example where we do have to worry about this is the Zeeman effect, or excuse me, is the Stark effect, where we have a perturbation that, if we have an electric field in the Z direction, that has that sort of formula. So we're going to be interested then in expectation values of Z. And it turns out that different states in the degenerate class do connect. And so we do have to go through this process. And it's not as bad as you might think because it is true that JZ commutes with Z. And so we only really have to look at states that have the same value of JZ. They're the ones that won't automatically. If we have different values of JZ, then we know that those states won't connect through V by that theorem. Okay, so the agenda for today is to look at the hydrogen atom and look at the real hydrogen atom as opposed to the hydrogen atom that Bohr presented. And we have all of these sets of states. And the idea is to get at least a lot of these right answers. Most of these right answers would come about automatically just by solving, instead of Schrodinger's equation, Dirac equation, right? The Dirac equation is the relativistically correct equation for electrons, spin 1/2 particles. And it's more or less, it's not tremendously difficult to solve the Dirac equation for the hydrogen atom. And then we would automatically get lots of these answers. We wouldn't have to do very much by hand the way we're going to end up doing. So automatically from the Dirac theory, the details that we've been worrying about, the anomalous gyromagnetic ratio of 2 and the Thomas precession, which we haven't talked about yet, all of those things come out automatically. We don't have to do anything by hand. We get the answers for free. And the upshot of this calculation is that the n squared degeneracy that we started out with Bohr is broken, and we have states that are degenerate if they have the same value of J. So in Dirac theory, this state and that state have exactly the same energy. This state and that state have the same energy. This state and that state have the same energy. Sometimes this is called the lambda degeneracy. We haven't, of course, in Dirac theory, put in any spin for the protons, so this hyperfine structure that has to do with the coupling of the nuclear spin with the electron spin is not going to be present. And we're also not going to get this Lamb shift. And we're not going to get the Lamb shift today either. So, kind of the standard road trip physics stories is that, well, so the Lamb shift theoretically comes about mostly by self-energy corrections. Of the electron. And in the context of Feynman diagrams, another version of perturbation, the electron emits a photon and we have an intermediate state, something like this E sub k, that consists of an electron and a photon. And we can calculate the energy of that intermediate state and try and do second order perturbation theory. And what we get is infinity. It has an ultraviolet divergence. And I don't know, so it's a worrisome feature when you get infinity for a quantity that should be small. People mostly ignored it until 1947 when somebody actually, when Lamb and Rutherford, not Rutherford, but Rutherford, actually experimentally discovered that these two guys don't have exactly the same energy. So there was a famous conference in 1947 at Shelter Island near New York, and it wasn't like modern conferences. So modern conferences have, you know, thousands of physicists giving dozens of simultaneous talks on lots of topics. This was more like a superstar conference. So if you look at the, I don't know, 50 some people who are invited to this conference, they're all names that I, well, maybe there are two or three names that I don't recognize, but basically they're all, at the time, the top of the field. And they got together and they were cogitating on what could exactly cause this Lamb shift. And the idea was that it was probably the self-energy of the electron, but no one could calculate it, or everyone who calculated it got infinity. So famously, Hans Bethe, on his way home from Cornell on the train, figured out how to do this non-relativistically. And so it was the start of this renormalization process, where kind of the key idea is that you really are interested in the difference in energy between an electron that's part of a hydrogen atom and an electron that's just floating free. Both of them are going to have this sort of process. And for both of them, it's going to contribute to its self-energy. So we really are interested in the difference between these two processes. So that leads to the kind of funny statement that, in some sense, the self-energy of every electron is infinite, and we just always subtract off that infinity when we're making these sort of comparisons. So the other famous kind of road trip story that goes along with this is the next summer, 1948. So people who are playing this game of these various complicated self-energy calculations include Schwinger. I don't know, is there an H in Schwinger? Somehow I don't, yeah, there must be. Feynman. I'm not sure I can spell Feynman's name. Tamanaka was also doing the same thing in Japan, but it was post-World War II, so people weren't really aware of what was going on in Japan. So Schwinger had a very complicated, special case way of calculating these sort of quantities called current algebra, and Feynman had a easy way of thinking about these geometrically, diagrammatically, and wasn't at all clear that there was any connection between them. Certainly, Feynman's way seemed like magic. It seemed to produce results kind of instantaneously, whereas Schwinger's methods were only for the gods, kind of. So Feynman and Dyson, the only name on the board that didn't get a Nobel Prize, took a road trip out to Los Alamos from New York. And on that road trip, they did a lot of talking about Feynman's ideas about how this all worked. And on the train trip back, Dyson saw that Schwinger's method and Feynman's methods were really the same method. And he kind of explained that to the rest of the physicists, that Feynman's kind of crazy twiggly diagrams actually were the same as the much harder Schwinger calculations. So Schwinger kind of negatively commented that Feynman diagrams brought quantum field theory to the masses, that normal people could calculate things like self-energy, not just Schwinger, which he thought was bad, apparently. Okay, so that's all we're going to say about renormalization. It's a complicated story. We can deal with the relativistic case. So what we're going to get out of the relativistic case is pretty much what Dirac would have given us for free. So we hope to show that these two states have the same energy, and these two states have the same energy. That is to say that the energy just depends on the J. Right? So this P one half, of course, comes about by a combination of the two P orbital angular momentum and the spin one half combining kind of anti-symmetrically to give us a net angular momentum that was one half, and of course they could add together to give us an angular momentum that's three halves. And so it goes. So what do we need to add for our perturbations? Well, you all know that E squared minus P squared C squared is MC squared squared, right? So that's the right formula for energy. And incidentally, it was the right formula that Schrodinger wrote down. So Schrodinger happily wrote down this formula as opposed to non-relativistic quantum mechanics, and was upset to find that it got the wrong answer for the energy levels of the hydrogen atom. So as a result, he never published the relativistic version of Schrodinger's equation, so it's called the Klein-Gordon equation instead. Okay, so if we rearrange this guy, we get that the energy is equal to the square root of mc squared squared plus pc squared. And this energy includes the rest energy of the particle, so the kinetic energy is given by that formula. And if we kind of factor out an mc squared out of everything, we're going to get 1 plus PC divided by MC squared squared, all of that to the 1/2 minus 1. And, you know, I hope it's no surprise that what we're going to get out of this is the kinetic energy is about equal to P squared over 2m, but there's going to be more to the series. So we're going to have a perturbed formula for the kinetic energy of the problem. And I hope you all remember this memorable Taylor series expansion, which allows us to do this series expansion pretty quick. So what we have here is that x is equal to minus PC over MC squared squared, and alpha is equal to minus 1/2. So what we've got then for this Taylor series expansion, in general, for any value of alpha, is 1 plus alpha over 1 factorial x plus alpha times alpha plus 1 over 2 factorial x squared plus higher order terms. So if we plug and chug through this, we've got 1 minus 1/2 of x, which is minus PC over MC squared squared, plus alpha is minus 1/2, so here we're going to have plus 1/2, so we're going to get minus 1/8 of x squared, which is PC over MC squared to the 4th. So this is 1 plus 1/2 P squared C squared divided by M squared C to the 4th. And then we've got minus 1/8 of, and I guess I'll leave this one the way it is. Okay, so if we multiply this term by MC squared, yeah, it all works out great. So let's do that. So we have 1/2 of PC over MC squared squared. Multiply that by this MC squared. And we get 1/2 P squared C squared divided by remaining MC squared. The M's go away and we get exactly that term. So for the second order term, it's going to be a negative term. So we've got 1/8 PC to the 4th divided by MC squared cubed after we cancel out one of the MC squareds. Okay, so this is a perturbation that we can find expectations of and figure out how the energy levels are going to change as a result. Okay, so first order perturbation theory with this perturbation that is 1/8, well, we might as well cancel off a lot of these MC squareds. So we're going to get P to the 4th. Here we have C to the 4th. Here we have C cubed. So we have M cubed C squared. Now remember that P squared is Laplacian. So when we put that potential, you know, between our wave functions, you know, it's not looking all that easy, right? So we have to take the Laplacian twice of psi in order to calculate that integral. But there's a cheap trick. So if we calculate that, we have this minus 1/8 over m cubed c squared, and we have psi p to the 4th psi, and we can mix and match, right? We can take one of those p squareds and have it operate on the bra as opposed to the ket, right? It's a Hermitian operator. We can bring it to the other side. And then we can use the Hamiltonian, right? So the Hamiltonian tells us that on this wave function psi, p squared over 2m plus the potential, which is minus e squared z divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r, right? The Coulomb potential. This gives me e times psi. And maybe confusingly, let me just call that v. This was the perturbing v, and this is the actual v. So what we have then is that p squared on psi is equal to 2m e minus v. And that looks a lot easier to integrate out, right? Because v is just a 1 over r term. So if I plug that in for those p squareds, I'm going to have a couple of those guys. So I'm going to have 1 over 2 now, mc squared, because I cancel off one of these m's. And then I'm going to have e minus v times psi, e minus v times psi. These are Hermitian operators, and in fact, they're just numbers, basically, so they can come together. So what we've got is minus 1 half over 2 mc squared psi of e minus v squared. And we can expand out this square. It's going to give us e squared minus 2e times v plus v squared. And I'm going to factor out an e from that. And then finally write things down again. Okay, so we're looking at the perturbing, the fact that the energy relativistically is not 1 half mv squared. There's this additional correction. And so the first order correction that we're working on, basically the extra addition to the kinetic energy, we've got minus e squared. Again, the energy is a constant, right? We know what it is for these states, 2mc squared. And then we have the expectation value of 1 minus 2v over e plus v squared over e squared. Psi. Well, 1, these states are normalized, so that's just going to give us 1. For this term here, we're going to get minus 2 times the formula for potential energy, which is minus z squared e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, all of this over e. And then we're going to have the expectation value of 1 over r. And you might remember you worked expectation values of things like 1 over r. So for the second term, we're going to have v squared. So we're going to have z e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught squared over e squared. And we're going to have the expectation value of 1 over r squared. And you didn't bother to prove those formulas, but it's doable. We're not going to do it today. It's kind of a mess. And what one finds is that the expectation value of 1 over r is 1 over n squared. By units, we better have something that has the units of 1 over r. Bohr radius is going to do it for us. And for 1 over r squared, we've got a L plus a half, and an N cubed, and an A squared. Okay. So, I don't know, it's helpful to think about the units of things. So we have this term e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught that's occurring pretty frequently. And I don't know about you, but I don't remember the units of epsilon naught very well. But if I kind of bring in some h bar c's, that's certainly exactly the same quantity. This quantity here is dimensionless if you work it out, and it's called the fine structure constant, and it's pretty much always denoted by alpha. Interestingly enough, it's not a constant. If you go through the process of field theory at very high energies, alpha changes slightly, but not at the energies we're talking about. So it's about equal to 137. So it's a small number. And it turns out that all of these perturbations can be parameterized in terms of increasing powers of alpha. Right, so if we add a power of alpha, then whatever we're talking about is 1% as big as it was before. So we're kind of going down in scale. And it's going to turn out that, well, so the overall energy of these states is 1/2 mc squared alpha squared divided by n squared. That's this quantity is the same thing as the 13.6 eV. So I already see that I'm starting to get lazy, and I'm probably pretty much going to think about the hydrogen atom as opposed to having some nucleus that has Z protons in it as opposed to just one proton in it. But if I bring in the, actually that's Z squared, if I bring in the nuclear charge, that's what it would be in general. That quantity, if you think about what its units are, so this is h bar divided by mc. H bar is momentum times position. And mc certainly has the units of momentum. So this quantity has the units of length. And it's typically called the Compton wavelength of a particle. So the Compton wavelength is, in some sense, the physical size of a particle. That is to say, because of relativity, it turns out that even if the particle fundamentally had a point size, it would be zigzagging around in some region that is a Compton wavelength. So the charge density of an electron, for example, is expected to be spread out over a Compton wavelength, kind of no matter what. The Compton wavelength is smaller than a Bohr radius, and it's just a factor of alpha down from a Bohr radius. So 1% of a Bohr radius is kind of the size of an electron. Interestingly enough, the size of a nucleus is kind of down another factor of alpha. So we can still be thinking about the proton as being basically a point particle. Although you can make corrections for the charge distribution inside of a proton. Okay, so if I write things in terms of these sorts of quantities, and I think I'm going to let the z go to 1 in what we're doing, what we're going to have here is going to be 2 times alpha times the Compton wavelength times mc squared divided by the the energy. And we can see then, I hope immediately, that the units of the Compton wavelength are going to be canceled by the units of 1 over r. And so this quantity is dimensionless, which is what it needed to be because it's being added and subtracted from 1. And we said that the Compton radius is just alpha times the Bohr radius. So what we've got here is 2 alpha squared mc squared divided by the energy. And then we've got the n squared that's going along for the ride. Okay, we can play the same game here. Again, letting z be 1. What I have here is alpha times the Compton radius times mc squared squared divided by e squared. And the 1 over r squared is going to give me something that has units of length that are going to cancel the units of length of that alpha. So what we've got here is alpha to the fourth from that term, and then we've got mc squared over the energy squared, and we've got this kind of ugly term, l plus a half n cubed left over. Okay, well, we can simplify this down a little bit more, remembering that the energy is given by that result. So what we have is a alpha squared mc squared here and an alpha mc squared there. This n squared is going to cancel that n squared, so this term is just going to be minus 4. The 1 half being going up to give us a 1 quarter. So play the same game here. We have alpha to the fourth. Mc squared is going to cancel. So we're going to have 2 when the energy goes up, when the alpha goes up. And we're going to have n squared going up and alpha squared, all of that squared. Minus sign, of course, disappearing because it's a squared quantity. Okay, so the alphas go away. We've got a 4 there. We've got 4 n's here. We've got 3 down there. So we've got n divided by l plus a half. Okay, so if we put all of these things together, what we've got then is we've got the minus e squared over 2mc squared. 1 minus 4 is going to give us minus 3. And then we've got plus 4n divided by l plus a half. Okay. So an important fact is that this doesn't depend on m, that is to say the azimuthal quantum number. It just depends on L. And you remember that the real states are going to be Clebsch-Gordan values of spin and orbital angular momentum, and so they're going to, in general, have different values of the z component of orbital angular momentum. But it's not going to matter, because, in fact, the expectation value is the same for all of those. Okay, so that's the relativistic answer. Incidentally, in terms of sign, remember that n has to be bigger than l, so that 4 is bigger than the minus 3, so this is a guaranteed negative departure. And that, of course, goes along with what we expected, because the term we originally started with was basically minus 8 p to the 4th, which also should be a guaranteed negative quantity. Okay. So the other term that we need to get in here is called the spin orbit term. And, I don't know, kind of the modern physics version of the spin orbit term is that if you're sitting on the electron, the proton is going around in circles, so it constitutes a current loop, which is going to make a magnetic field that's going to interact with you. And I guess that's fine, but we can do better. So if you remember back to E&M, we talked about what would happen if you were boosted, if you switch to a different frame of reference, and what the electric and magnetic fields would be as a result. And one of the things we showed was that the magnetic field that you would pick up if you were moving was minus your velocity crossed into the electric field divided by c squared. So just as a result of switching frames, oh, and there's actually a gamma in there. So that came from Lorentz transforming the F mu nu tensor. And we're going to, the velocities that we're in, this is already a fairly small quantity because it has a V over C in it. So we're going to just have this gamma be 1 at our current level of calculation. And we know, of course, that the energy that the electron will experience is going to be minus mu dot the magnetic field that it's got. And classically, this magnetic moment is the charge divided by 2m times the angular momentum. Of course, the charge on an electron is negative. So we end up, well, let's carry this through one more step. So the electric field that we have from the nucleus is going to be ze squared over r cubed in the r direction. And if I switch around the order, I've got stuff that looks a whole lot like angular momentum. So what I've got here is ze squared over r cubed. Let me bring in a mass. And then what we've got is R cross MV for this magnetic field. Okay, so it just turns out that the magnetic field that the electron experiences is exactly related to the orbital angular momentum that the electron experiences. And the corresponding potential energy then, So we took care of this minus sign by switching around the R and the V. We still have these two minus signs, which are going to cancel. So we've got E divided by 2m ze squared over mc squared r cubed. And then we've got L dot s. So it's spin orbit coupling. So the same thing for nuclear processes was worth a Nobel Prize, figuring out that there is a strong L dot S coupling in the nuclear force, putting nucleons into potential wells that are the nucleus. Okay, so this isn't all that hard because remember that L dot S is just 1/2 J squared minus L squared minus S squared. And S squared is, of course, going to be 3/4 H bar squared from S plus 1/2 squared. This is going to give us H bar squared LL plus 1. This one's going to give us H bar squared J plus 1. And we've got two cases, right? We've got the case where J is equal to L plus 1/2 and J is equal to L minus 1/2, according to whether the spin and the orbital angular momentum are aligned or anti-aligned. So we're going to get two different values for this quantity. And we might as well work out what those two values are. So let's pull out an H bar squared from everything and kind of rewrite it. So we've got E over 2m ze squared over mc squared r cubed H bar squared, and then L dot S over H bar squared is going to be 1/2 of all of this stuff. J plus 1 minus LL plus 1 minus 3/4 for the electron. Ooh, I apologize. So, in some units, we don't need that 4 pi epsilon naught, but if we're going to use MKS units, then we need that 4 pi epsilon naught. And maybe before we calculate that JJ plus 1, let's work out what the units are going to be of all of this mess that we've got here. So we've got a E squared over 4 pi epsilon naught. And remember that I needed an H bar C in order to make that be the fine structure constant. And I've got another E over 2m, and I've got a mc squared, and I've got an h bar squared. Did I miss anything? I don't think so. Okay, so remember that we can take all of those quantities, and that's equal to the Compton wavelength squared. And if I bring in another MC, then I've got a Compton wavelength cubed. So what we've got here is alpha Compton wavelength cubed, mc squared is left over. And that's just what we need, right? Because we need something to cancel the units of that r cubed, and we know that we want to get something that has units of energy out. Okay, so what's this what's this quantity in brackets? So let's first work the case where J is equal to L minus a half. So what I have then is L minus a half times L plus a half minus L squared minus L minus 3/4. And if I multiply all of this out, what I'm going to get is L squared. These terms are going to cancel, so I'm going to get minus 1/4. The L squareds go away. This guy combines to give me 1. So I get minus L minus 1 for the quantity in brackets under that circumstance. If J is equal to L plus 1/2, then what I've got is L plus 1/2 times L plus 3/2 minus L squared minus L minus 3/4. So this term here is going to cancel that. We're going to have an L squared that's going to cancel that. And here, if we do the cross terms, we're going to get 2L, and we have to subtract off an L. So that quantity in square brackets is either equal to L or minus L plus 1, depending upon whether whether we're in the aligned spin state or the anti-aligned spin state. Okay, so there's only one more thing to do, and that's to figure out what the expectation value is of 1 over r cubed. And that turns out to be a trickier process than the previous ones, which were, while not assigned, at least you could see that it was possible to do. This one actually has mathematical problems. If you think about the case L equals 0, the wave function goes to a constant for small r. So this is going to end up being the integral of 1 over r cubed r squared integrated in the vicinity of 0. And the integral of 1 over r down to 0 involves the natural logarithm of 0, which is undefined large negative number. So technically speaking, we can only say what this is when L isn't equal to 0. But it turns out that if we naively apply the formula even in cases where L is 0, it gives us the right answer. So this thing is equal to 1 over L. That's indicating that problems are going to occur when L is equal to 0. L plus 1/2, L plus 1, n cubed, a squared, a cubed. Okay, so if we put together all of the pieces, we have that the contributions due to spin orbit are equal to alpha cubed divided by L plus 1/2, L plus 1, n cubed, and then we've got 1/4, either L or minus L minus 1, depending upon which state we're talking about, all times mc squared. Okay, I hope we can see where all of these alphas came from. We have this original alpha. When we take the Compton wavelength and divide it by the Bohr radius, that gives us the other alpha cubed, and the other quantities are there for the ride. Okay, so now there's kind of a little trick that is useful to apply. So in the top case, what we're going to end up with is 1 over L plus 1/2 times L plus 1. And notice that L plus 1 under this circumstance is exactly the same as J plus 1/2, right? Because J is equal to L plus 1/2. In the other circumstance, we're going to cancel off this term, and we're going to get minus L plus a half. And notice that L is exactly equal to J plus a half, because J is equal to L minus a half. So under all circumstances, we just get plus or minus 1, depending upon which case we're in. We've got alpha to the fourth divided by L plus a half, J plus a half, and we have n cubed and a quarter times mc squared. Okay, so it's looking kind of like a mess at this point. What we have is values for the spin orbit coupling and values for the relativistic effect. And I probably won't bother to do this on the board. It turns out there's kind of a neat cancellation, and in the end, the answer is just that. So I hope you can see it has the right units, energy squared canceling mc squared. And now there aren't two cases. That's kind of the magic. Basically, this plus minus 1 again combines with the value of j to give us a form that doesn't have two cases. And what this means is that the energy just depends on J. It doesn't depend on which case we're in. So that means that these two guys are going to have the same energy because they have the same value of J. These two guys are going to have the same energy because they have the same value of J. So kind of a magic cancellation happens between this spin orbit case. Okay, so there's only one other thing that we can solve for getting the true spectrum of hydrogen, and that's the interaction between the proton's magnetic dipole moment and the electron's magnetic dipole moment. And we worked the formula for what the magnetic field was in E and M from a point dipole. And I'm not sure I'm going to try and write it in something like that. But the main point is that it's spherically symmetric. That if we integrate that over an S wave, we're going to get zero. Okay, well, that's not sounding good because I show that there's a split there. And the split actually comes about because there is another term here that is a delta function. So that came into play in E and M in a few circumstances, but kind of what's going on physically. Exactly this same formula applied for an electric dipole moment. For an electric dipole moment, it has exactly the field at distance, but you know, right on top of the dipole, the electric field is going to be pointing down. Whereas if we have a little solenoid that has exactly the same magnetic field outside of it, right inside of the solenoid, the magnetic field is going to be pointing up. So for point dipoles, there is this extra term, and that's a very easy term to integrate out, right? So all we're going to get is the value of the wave function squared evaluated right at the origin. And that's something we can happily calculate. Now we are going to have two states, right? We're going to have a triplet state where the spin and the electron are aligned, and a singlet state where the electron spin and the proton spin are anti-aligned. And there's a small energy difference between these two states, proportional to the value of the wave function right on top of the proton, and that's what gives rise to this famous 21 centimeter line where we have the spin flip light. So I don't know, how does this work kind of more generally? So in general, you might have a nucleus that has I angular momentum, and we would want to add that to the total spin orbit angular momentum of the electron. And this is going to produce a total angular momentum, sometimes called F. And so in general, we're going to have states that are separated according to this total value of angular momentum. So it's a little bit simpler in the case of the hydrogen atom, where we just have spin 1/2 added to spin 1/2. Okay, so we've got all the story. The Lamb shift takes beta to calculate that non-relativistically. We're not going to go there. But otherwise, we've got what we need to explain that version of the spectra. So the date certain for the